seeming to double in size. In a single leap, she cleared the ledge and then flew down the slope. No! Back! Home! Back! She flashed through the grasses. The panic in her voice only seemed to spur Runt on. He rose again to her position, and then loped in joyful bounds toward her. Pax pounced on the wire, but he was too late. Just as he stripped off its sheathing, a dark odor of lightning blew through the earth. A jolt of current shattered one of its back teeth. It seared his bottom lip, scorched his throat, and sizzled down his spine. And then a swath of lower field exploded into the sky. Pax was knocked off the ledge, and when he hit solid ground again, tangled in uprooted shrubbery, the broken world went silent. His skull rang in the silence, and he watched shock still as the storm of hot dirt and rocks and branches and weeds rained down upon him, and then wasted itself to a veil of grit. He staggered to his feet and sucked the burned air into his flattened lungs until his head cleared. Then he rose on his haunches to sniff for Runt and Bristle. He tried for them in all directions, but his nose was useless, the fine-scenting nerves numbed by ash and soot. He barked for them, but the ringing in his ears was still the only sound he heard. Pax worked his way out of the pile of brush and shook off the debris. Soldiers streamed down the hill across the smoking patch of field and then plunged into the river. When they had passed, he followed. Each movement sent aftershocks through his bones. Where he had last seen them, he called again for Runt and Bristle. There was no answer, but, faintly at first, as if they were reaching his ears from a great distance away, he heard his own barks, and then the sound of the wind, and the snapping of seared weed stalks as he crashed through them, and the rough shouts of the war-sick men as they returned to the trenches. And from the trees, a murder of crows cawing their displeasure at the ruined world. Pax could hear again. For an hour he paced the field, calling for the missing foxes. Dusk fell before he finally heard it. Bristle's weak, answering yelp. He followed the call to the river's edge. There, the scrub oak was lying splintered and smoking over the bank, its blackened branches in the water. Pax found Bristle, tucked into the earthy ball of its roots. Her head was up, and her eyes were alert, although her muzzle was matted with blood. The fur of her beautiful brush was burned to a black crust. Pax nosed her face. The blood on her cheeks was not hers. She dropped her head. Curled beneath her was the still body of Runt. Pax dipped his head to the little fox's chest. It rose and fell in ragged hitches, and Pax was relieved. But then Bristle shifted and he saw, where Runt's hind leg should have been, where the neat black furred leg and the quick white paw should have been, there was only a shredded red mess on the blood-soaked leaves. Chapter 20 Peter rubbed the chisel handle with the oiled steel wool, trying to resist the urge to throw it across the barn. The morning had been good. He'd crutched over field and woods, through mud and gravel, up hills and down rock faces, over stone walls and under fences. Strong, tireless, and nearly as fast as if he'd had both boots on the ground. At noon, he'd told Vola he felt ready to go now. And he was. But she had ignored him as usual. She ordered him into the barn to rest and taken his crutches hostage. Foot up, polish some tools, get the hand feel of them. His gaze fell on the near-finished carving in front of him on the workbench. The fox was rough, but it looked alive, and it seemed to him a sign that he would find Pax unharmed. Although it felt dangerous to hope, he allowed himself to imagine the scene. He would call for Pax at the spot where he'd left him, and Pax would come bursting out of the woods and probably knock him down in his happiness. They would go home together.
"You're going to polish that handle right off, boy."
Peter jumped. "I didn't hear you come in."
"You can't go drifting off when you're working with tools." Vola settled herself on a barrel beside him and picked up a rasp and an oily cloth. I was thinking about Pax. He put down the gleaming chisel and picked up his carving. He handed it over when Vola held out a palm.
Looks like he wants to jump out of my hand.
You're worried about him? Peter nodded.
But half the time, I think he could be all right. Foxes are smart, really smart. We had to lock the door to the kitchen because Pax could open every cupboard. Once, he chewed through the wire to a fan we'd just put in my room. My father was really mad. But then, when he was trying to fix it, he found out the fan had a short in the housing. It would have caught fire. I think Pax knew that somehow. That he was protecting me. So why wouldn't he be smart enough to learn to hunt? Don't you think he could survive?
I do, Vola agreed. Peter took the carving back and looked into the fox's face.
There's something else, he said.
It's that I would know if he died.
And then he told Vola what he'd never told anyone else. About the merging he felt sometimes with Pax. How sometimes he didn't just know what his fox was feeling, but actually felt it himself. He held his breath, hearing how crazy it sounded. Instead of laughing, Vola told him he was lucky.
You've experienced two, but not two. That's on your board. Two, but not two.
I didn't know what it meant.
It's a Buddhist concept, non-duality. It's about oneness, about how things that seem to be separate are really connected to one another. There are no separations.
Vola picked up his fox again. This is not just a piece of wood. This is also the clouds that brought the rain, that watered the tree, and the birds that nested in it, and the squirrels that fed on its nuts. It is also the food my grandparents fed me that made me strong enough to cut the tree, and it's the steel in the axe I used. And it's how you know your fox, which allowed you to carve him yesterday, and it's the story you will tell your children when you give this to them. All these things are separate, but also one. Inseparable. Do you see? Two, but not two. Inseparable.
So,
a couple of nights ago, I was sure that Pax had eaten. I felt it. Last night, I saw the moon, and I knew Pax was seeing it right then, too.
You think that if I feel Pax living, then he's alive?
Yes.
Peter's hope swelled at her words.
Vola never said anything she didn't mean.
We tell the truth here. That's the rule. She told him that about 100 times.
It was a valuable thing, he suddenly realized, to have someone you could count on for honesty. How many times in his life had he wanted only that? How many questions had he needed an honest answer for, and gotten instead from his father? Dark silence. And then, before he could chicken out, he asked the one that haunted him.
Do you think if someone had a wild part, it could ever be tamed out?
If it's in his nature, inherited.
Vola looked at him hard.
Peter knew she thought he was asking about Pax, and he didn't correct her. He picked up the chisel again and looked down at it on his lap. His fingers squeezed white around the shank as he waited for the answer.
You always been like this? Asking other people to figure out your stuff for you, eh?
That doesn't work.
Peter let out his breath. As soon as he'd asked the question, he'd realized he didn't want to hear the answer. Maybe he would never be ready to hear the answer to that question.
Vola patted her overall pocket and frowned.
Almost forgot.
She pulled out a napkin-wrapped muffin and handed it to Peter. He'd eaten 4 of them at breakfast, but she was always convinced that he wasn't eating enough. He unwrapped it. It was a little squashed, but as with the rest of them, the pecan was centered perfectly on the brown sugar topping. She'd stayed up late last night baking them, and he had heard her singing something in a language he didn't recognize. Something happy.
Vola, why are you still living out here alone?
I told you.
But 20 years to figure out who you are? I mean, how hard can it be?
Plenty hard.
The plain truth can be the hardest thing to see when it's about yourself.
If you don't want to know the truth, you'll do anything to disguise it.
Peter put the muffin down. She was avoiding his question.
But you do. You know yourself.
So how come you don't go live somewhere with people?
Tell me the truth.
That's the rule around here, right? She looked at the barn window for a minute. Her shoulders slumped, and when she turned to him, she looked tired.
Fair enough.
No bet, Peter.
Maybe it's because I do know myself. Maybe what I know is that I don't belong with people.
Maybe I am a grenade.
What do you mean, a grenade?
What would you call someone who can go from a girl eating peaches and watching fireflies to a woman who kills a man, eh? That girl would have cut off her arm before she'd have hurt a single one of those fireflies. But a few years later, she killed a perfect stranger.
I'd call that person a weapon. I'm an unpredictable, deadly weapon. It's best I stay hidden here, where no one will ever be hurt by me, even by accident.
She raised her fingers and popped them at him. Boom!
But this time the gesture looked sad, not menacing.
You don't hurt me, Peter answered.
How do you know I won't?
Because I know.
He thumped his chest.
In my core.
Vola slapped her palms on the workbench and pushed herself off.
Put those tools back in the right order, she muttered over her shoulder as she left. From the window, Peter watched her stamp down the path. It seemed she was moving differently, as if that heart pine leg of hers had grown even heavier. One by one, Peter slid the cleaned tools into their pockets and then rolled the canvas. He felt his old anxiety coiling at the base of his skull. Over a week he'd been stuck here. He would have left already if it hadn't been for the third condition. He'd promised, and he owed it to Vola, but when he'd asked her at breakfast about building the stage, she'd only shrugged.
I'll get to it.
And then the solution hit him, so ridiculously simple that he laughed out loud. Without his crutches, he was awkward and slow again, but he managed to hop outside to where Vola kept a brush pile. There, he chose 12 long, straight saplings, each the thickness of his arm. One by one, he flung them to the barn doorway, then followed and slid them inside. On the sawhorses, he stripped them of their branches, then set to work. And 2 hours later, he had a stage. It wasn't much to look at. The corners, raggedly notched and lashed with twine. Mismatched scrapboards nailed onto the frame for the walls and floor. But when he strung a length of burlap over the top, he smiled.
Piece of cake, he said to Francois, who wandered in and stopped to sniff the frame in obvious admiration.
Piece of cake. I made the stage. It's in the barn.
Vola looked up from the chicken she was plucking. She eyed the branch Peter was leaning on and then motioned to his crutches, propped against the kitchen counter. Peter reached for them, slid them under his arms, and felt the immediate comfort they brought.
I can do that puppet show for you now. Come to the barn.
I have work to do now, but all right. Tonight.
And then I can leave, Vola.
I'm ready.
Vola laid the chicken on the table and sighed.
You are not ready. You sleep indoors, dry and warm. You have clean water and someone cooks your food for you. But all right. Tomorrow I will test you. 10 miles. You hike 5 miles, show me you can make a camp on one leg, and hike 5 miles back. Then we'll talk.
Peter watched her gather up the chicken feathers and tuck them into a pouch, and it struck him.
Nothing would change after he left.
Vola would save her feathers, would make her puppets all alone in the woods,
more and more and more of them, and tell that soldier's story to no one.
Chapter 21 Pax watched Runt all night, and into the next day, from a bush not far away. He left only to soothe his burned lip in the cool river mud, and make a meal of the small fish he found lying on the bank. His sense of smell returned, and whenever he woke from a fitful doze, he sniffed for Bristle and Runt to reassure himself that they were still alive. Bristle had dragged Brush to the fallen tree to shelter her brother, and curled her body over his to keep him warm. She left him briefly a few times, and when she did, Pax quietly took her place beside Runt's motionless form. He was there when Runt finally woke with a whimper. Pax nuzzled Runt's shoulder to comfort him. Runt lifted his head. His eyes were clouded with pain and fear. He cried out again, and Bristle, who had been hunting nearby, trotted back to him. Pax pulled back, respectful, but Bristle merely settled herself alongside her brother, her cheek beside his. Pax bent to Runt's wound and licked it cautiously, wary of Bristle's reaction. She watched him carefully, but did not object. Pax set to a thorough cleaning of the wound. Runt watched him with a trusting gaze and did not flinch. When Pax finished, he cleaned Runt's face and ears, and Bristle allowed it. When Runt had fallen asleep again, Pax stayed beside the two. Together, he and Bristle watched the activity of the camp. Although the humans did not return to the ruined part of the field, the scents were dangerous. When the wind was from the west, carrying the smell of burned land, the men seemed tense. More arrived at the camp, with more machines. At the sudden growl of an engine, Bristle jumped. She laid her head back over her brother's. I must move him soon. Humans cannot scent. If we are hidden from view, we are safe. Bristle looked from him to the men. We are not safe if a single human is nearby. Bristle seemed lessened to Pax, as if a vital piece of her had disappeared. He knew that somehow the humans had taken it. My boy does not bring harm. He is not like them. He is not war-sick. The war-sick are full-grown. He is still young. No, it is another difference. Pax was sure of this, but he was also confused. Over the past year, Peter had grown taller and stronger, and his voice had deepened. But more than that, his scent had changed. It was no longer the scent of a child. He is not young, but he is not war-sick. The last day I saw him, he cared for me, although he himself was in pain. His eyes shed water. His eyes were wounded. Pax thought for a moment about the mystery of crying. No, when he is hurt in other places, his eyes shed water. It streams down his face. I think the pain is relieved by the flowing water. But his breath, he gulps for air as though this pain water may be drowning him. The vixen bent to lick more dried blood from her sleeping brother's haunch. After a while, she raised her gaze to Pax. And in it, Pax saw the terrible things that had been done to her family by humans. And then Pax understood something. Peter had thrown the toy into the woods that last day. The pain water had been flowing from his eyes, but he had thrown the toy. And he had not followed. My boy is not war-sick, but he has changed. He is now false acting. Chapter 22 Peter lit the four big lanterns hanging from the barn rafters. The tools, the sharpening wheel, the wall full of puppets, all glowed warm and cheerful in the cones of amber light. Even the hay shone like Rumpelstiltskin's gold. The barn looked reborn, but familiar. He knew it like a home now. Home.
as soon as he'd put on Vola's puppet show, just another hour from now, he would finally be free to start out again. He lit the two small lanterns near the stage and lifted Sinbad from the wall. Showtime! The marionette's black eyes looked back at him blankly. Peter checked the joints, still amazed that Vola had taken the puppet apart, just so he could learn its secrets. And suddenly Vola's secret philosophy card flashed in his mind. I would have been a good teacher. She was right about that. He thought about how easily she suggested techniques in his drills without making a big deal of anything. How she had him watch while she carved, then let him figure out things for himself. How she asked him questions about everything and didn't answer for him. But she was all wrong about being too dangerous to be near people. Anyone who knew her would tell her that. The problem was that no one knew her, except maybe him. He hung the marionette back on the wall. I think, Sinbad, I'm going to give you the night off. He went outside and fished a wrist-thick limb out of the brush pile. Back inside, he sawed off the ends and nailed on a base. He lashed the rock's tin bowl nest to the top, then fixed it on the stage. Next, he lifted the sorceress puppet from its perch and unscrewed its left leg. Ready? Vola called out. Peter climbed the stack of hay bales he'd set up behind the stage and picked up the sorceress's controls, surprised his hands weren't shaking. Because, suddenly, everything he'd been so sure of an hour ago now seemed like a terrible idea. When she'd come into the barn, Vola had been wearing a long purple skirt instead of her overalls, and she had combed her hair, something Peter had never seen before. She had been astounded at the stage he'd built, and it hadn't been an act. You have the makings of a woodworker, she said. If I were in the market for an apprentice, I'd offer you the spot. In another few minutes, what would she think of him? It was too late for second-guessing, though. Ready, he lied. Vola turned down the four overhead lanterns, then Peter heard her drag a stool to the middle of the barn. This is the story of a girl, he said. He heard Vola take in a sharp breath, and then he didn't hear a sound after that. Not when he pulled the curtain and drew the sorceress up from the plank. Not when the seed corn he'd piled on her stomach like peaches spilled off. Not when he wrapped her in his camouflage t-shirt, tucked her hair into a clay bowl helmet, and slid the stick into her hand as a rifle. Not when he had her shoot the rifle. Not when he unscrewed her leg. Not when he made her climb to the nest. Peter had expected a protest, when he lit the nest on fire. But still, Vola didn't make a sound. And just as he'd practiced, the fire was only a momentary flare as the handful of wood shavings in the bowl flashed up, just enough time for him to take off the marionette's army uniform. He drew her up out of the nest and eased her to the stage, where he'd propped the child puppet beside his carved fox. He had her bend low to the child, then turn and stroke the fox, and then he pulled the curtain. Peter hung the controls. He waited, but still there was only silence. He stretched to look over the stage. Vola stared straight ahead, right through him, her face as rigid as if it had been carved of wood. The tears streaming down her cheeks gleamed in the flickering light. Somehow, they only served to make her look noble. I'm sorry. I only meant... You're not a grenade. You're good. You took me in. You're training me so I can get Pax. Leave me alone, boy. Her voice was low and wire tight. Wait. I think it's stupid to waste your life out here for some kind of punishment. I mean, maybe that guy didn't even care about that book. Maybe he won it in a poker game the night before. Maybe what he cared about was... I don't know. Peter steeled himself. Being a teacher or something. At the word, teacher, Vola shot her chin at him. but he didn't look away. Yeah, maybe he wanted to be a teacher. So maybe you should go do that for him. But you'll never know, so I think you should go out and live your life. I'm just saying that whatever bad thing wrecked you before, you could start over like the Phoenix, and I know what you're saying. You're not wrong. But get out of here now. Leave me be. Peter started to argue, but his words withered at the sight of her sitting so still, head so high, tears now rolling down her neck. He wrapped the sorceress's controls and then climbed down from the hay bales and picked up his crutches. The silence of the barn felt enormous. Okay. Okay, he said. Just to break it. The walk to the cabin in the dark took forever. Inside, a covered plate rested on the counter. He slumped against the doorframe, washed in guilt. Vola had made it up for him from the dinner leftovers. You pick this chicken clean later tonight, you hear me? A fresh wave of guilt. She'd killed a chicken. Something she didn't do often, because she wanted him to have more protein. Peter shoved off from the doorframe and scooped up a box of matches for beside the stove. He had no idea how long she'd stay out there, but when she came back, it wouldn't be to a cold, dark cabin. This much he could do for her. He lit all the lamps and then laid a fire just the way he'd seen Vola do it each night. Sitting there, watching it catch and grow, he replayed everything he'd said. It had all been true. Well, the part about that soldier maybe wanting to be a teacher had probably pushed it. But who knew? Maybe he had. No, there wasn't a single thing he hadn't meant to say. Nothing he regretted. A gust blew down the chimney, threatening the fragile fire. He reached for another section of newspaper. As he crumpled it, a headline caught his eye. Forces prepare to engage. Area to be evacuated. He flattened the sheet and read. He studied the map, unbelieving. And then he grabbed his crutches and pegged out to the porch so fast that Francois scrambled from his nest and shot out into the night. He jammed his clothes into his pack, then looked around. The Phoenix bracelet, the photo of his mother, and his mitt and ball were the only things of his in the room. He propped the bracelet on the hammock where Vola would find it, dropped the other things into the pack, and swung up into the kitchen. Vola was just coming in. She hung her hat on the peg and looked over to the fire, then back at him, at his pack. He handed the sheet of newspaper to her. Vola scanned it, then looked up for an explanation. He pointed at the map. The area they're closing off? He choked. That's only 5 miles from where I left Pax. Are you sure? It's a big area. I'm sure. See this empty place? It's an abandoned rope mill. It's got all these high stone walls and it sits overlooking the river at the only place you can cross it. The rest is gorge. That's where they'll fight for the water. My friends and I used to play war at that mill. We said it was the perfect place for an ambush. We played war. I left Pax on the road leading up to it thinking it would be... The word safe stuck in his throat. He shot up and lurched over to the pegs at the door to grab his sweatshirt. Stop. They're preparing for battle there. Don't be crazy. It's not crazy. It's right. I know it now. Remember the cheese? You asked what kind I liked and I didn't know. My father likes cheddar, so that's what we have. Maybe I used to like something else. It's like you said. I had that forgetting who you are disorder. I didn't remember what was right and what was wrong when I left Pax. But now I do. Now I know I need to go there. I know that. All right. Maybe so. But you're still on one leg, boy. It isn't possible. Look at this distance. Vola sat down with the map. No, I've wasted enough time. I'm not listening anymore. Hold on. Vola lifted the paper. You come over here. See something. Peter frowned, but he swung back over. Robert Johnson? Bus driver friend I've been telling you about, who's been mailing your letters? See this spot here? She tapped the top left corner of the map in the article. That town is the final stop on his route. He passes through here at 11:10, Tuesdays and Saturdays, and this is where he pulls up at the end of the night. What if I put you on that bus tomorrow? Seems like that would save you at least 250 miles. Leave you about 40 to cover on your own. You listening now? Peter dropped his crutches and sank to the chair, jelly-legged with relief. You'd do that for me? Only 40 miles? That's nothing. No. 40 miles across woods and hills on crutches is not nothing. 3 days at least, I'd figure. And it'll just about kill you. But I think you can do it. So you'll stay the night now. Deal? Peter took her hand and met her gaze. Deal. Looking at Vola, her face still tear-streaked from what had happened in the barn, he knew he couldn't leave things as broken as they were. And he didn't have much time to fix them. Deal, he said again. On three conditions.
Chapter 23. The moon shone through the trees as full and creamy yellow as the eggs Pax had eaten a week before. His stomach cramped as he paced the river's edge. Only 3 times in the week and a half since his humans had left him had he eaten a meal big enough to fill his belly. And the last one, a pile of fish rotting on the bank, he'd retched up minutes later. He had retrieved the cached ham and watched with pride as Bristle and Runt ate the meat, but he hadn't touched any of it. And he still had no luck hunting. All his fat reserves were gone. His coat hung loose, and he was burning muscle. Pax strained his nose to the humans' camp, which has always tortured him with its rich food scents. Over the past 2 days, more warsick had arrived, and hundreds of them were massing to the south beyond. The ground vibrated with their threat. But Pax was hungry. He looked over to where Bristle was guarding the sleeping Runt and signaled that he would leave. Although he could see the camp directly above him, he chose his old route, up the gorge and across the ridge, because the guards on the wall were facing the river. He padded up the rocks in the water, leaving no tracks. Away from the silence of the devastated field, his ears pricked toward the night sounds. He knew them now. They comforted him. The thin piping of bats, the careless crashing of a waddling skunk, the underground bustle of voles, the distant calls of owls. All these sounds told him he was not hunting alone. Pax himself made no noise. He had learned the secrets of stealth from Gray and Bristle. Like a shadow, he slipped across the ridge, down the hill, and into the grub tent. No easy meat hung this night, but the tables were piled high with vegetables and breads. He knocked a wheel of cheese to the ground. The taste was strong and strange, but he gulped until his belly stretched tight. As he headed back out, carrying a hunk for Bristle, a familiar scent stopped him in his tracks. Peanut butter. It was drifting out of a large metal can. Pax dropped the cheese. He stood to sniff at the rim. Like the garbage bin at his boy's home, the can promised a variety of scraps. But above the commingled scents rose the one he craved more than any other. His whiskers ruffled in pleasure. He nudged the lid aside a few inches. The clear jar lay on top of the heap, its sides still smeared thick with the creamy prize. Pax edged his snout under the lid and bit the top of the rim carefully. He knew from experience that this was how to grip the jar so it didn't cover his nose. He pushed away from the garbage can. The lid clattered to the stony ground, ringing an alarm in the quiet night. Pax ducked under the table and froze. His pulse quickened. Across the tent, the flap snapped open. A human stepped in and clicked on a beam of light. Even over the peanut butter, Pax recognized the scent. His boy's father. Pax raised a paw, ready to dart in whatever direction seemed safest. The man swept the light around the tent. When it fell on Pax's eyes, he winced, but he didn't move. His pupils adjusted, and Pax saw the man crouch to stare at him. Pax remained frozen, paw still raised, jar still clamped in his jaws, studying the man's face as the man studied his. The man grunted, rubbing his chin. Then he gave a rough laugh. Pax lowered his paw an inch, holding the man's gaze, testing him. His boy's father laughed again, then rose and lifted the tent flap. He kicked his boot through the opening. Pax knew the signal. The man had used it on him often at the door of the human's house, at the door of his pen. "Go through," it meant. "Go through right now and I won't harm you." The pact was reliable. Pax sped past him and into the safety of the night. He didn't slow down until he reached the spine of the hill. He buried the jar and then crouched to watch for movement at the camp in the pre-dawn light. Although he was certain no humans had followed him, he took off east, snaking a loose loop for half an hour before doubling back to drop down to the river. Runt was awake when Pax returned, and for the first time since the explosion, he was struggling to rise. Bristle urged him back down, but Pax saw that his lips were cracked and his eyes sunken. "He needs water." Bristle looked at the river's edge, a dozen full bounds for a healthy fox. Would it even be possible for Runt? The little fox braced his forelegs. He tightened his haunches to rise, then looked back in surprise. The leg that had been part of him his whole life, as much a part of him as his own scent, was gone. He bent and sniffed at the wound. He looked up at Pax, and then Bristle, as if searching for an explanation. Again he strained upward. His one remaining back leg jacked him up, and Runt rolled onto his wounded haunch with a yelp of pain. Pax leaped to stand by his injured side. Runt got to his front legs once more, and then straightened his one back leg. Again he canted over. This time, though, he fell against the strong, tall flank of the older fox, and he did not cry out. He wobbled, searching for a new balance. When he found it, Pax took a single step toward the water, then waited. Runt stepped out. First, the two front legs, then a dragging hop with a single back leg, and a collapse against Pax. Again, Pax took a single step. Again, the small fox matched it. And again, and once more until he didn't waver at all. Bristle ran ahead to the bank, and step by wounded step, Runt closed the distance until he flopped down by the riverbank and stretched his neck out to lap at the cool water. When he was sated, he dropped his head, his eyes closing. But Bristle nipped him. Soon it would be full daylight. He would be exposed. She ran upriver to a stand of cattails. Runt limped after her. He was still clumsy and trembling and slow, but he did not fall once. Pax followed close by. Just as they reached the stand of reeds, Pax startled at the crackling of brush from downstream. Bristle's head snapped around too, ears cocked to the same spot across the river. Something large was coming. Runt dipped his head to sniff at a snail. Pax and Bristle backed into the cattail reeds. Bristle called to her brother. Runt did not turn his head. A buck pranced out of the vegetation, tossed his antlers, then splashed into the river. Bristle barked for her brother again, and again he ignored her. The deer clattered up onto the other bank, heading for the bright grass of an unscorched area of field. At its edge, he lifted a hoof. As he set it down, the earth rocked and the bright grass blew. The buck burst up, his back twisting and snapping. Runt screamed his terror at the quaking ground. Bristle and Pax herded him into the cool dark of the reeds and soothed him, until he understood that he was unharmed. The foxes watched the soldiers run down the hill, sweep their beams of light over the heap in the field, then go back. As a pink sun rose over the pines, vast patches of grass in the field flared up and crackled. Field mice stumbled out toward the cool safety of the riverbank. Dazed and disoriented, they would have made easy meals, but Bristle let them pass, as if obeying some code that protected those so terrified. She stood and gazed over the smoking field. "We have to leave here. Now." Pax knew that she was right. He followed her out of the reeds. Bristle called to Runt, who was watching a wandering vole. He didn't even flick his ears toward his sister. And Pax understood. He can't hear. Chapter 24. When Peter came into the kitchen, he found Vola already drinking coffee. She couldn't have slept any more than he had. He'd heard her leave for the barn in the middle of the night, and she hadn't come back until nearly dawn. She raised her mug. "Breakfast before you go?" He shook his head. Vola nodded and took his pack from him. She stuffed a brown paper bag into it. "Eat the ham sandwiches first. Ham won't keep. There's a jar of salve. Put it on twice a day. I filled your thermos, but you'll have to be on the lookout for springs. Keep that cask dry, though. I mean it. Tape a garbage bag around it if it rains." She set the pack down, and Peter noticed. She had two shoes on. "Hey, you're wearing it." She lifted her overall cuff. "Condition number one." "Wow." Peter managed after a minute. "Holy diable, man. Where's the old one?" Vola tipped her head to the armchair. "I don't know what to do with it. Maybe put it on the scarecrow?" "Not on the scarecrow," Peter answered instantly sure. He pointed to the fireplace. "The phoenix, remember? All his stuff burns in the nest." Vola sighed, but she followed him. Peter stirred the embers and added some kindling. Vola brought the wooden post over. It looked smaller somehow. The leather straps reminded Peter of the ones binding the marionette's feet and hands. "You okay?" "I'm okay." Vola placed the wooden leg onto the flames, and both of them watched until it caught. Vola walked away first. Peter noticed how smooth her gait was with a prosthesis. You wouldn't even guess. He pulled the screen over the fire. When she got home today, there'd be nothing but a pile of ashes. "You okay with the other two conditions?" he asked, trailing her to the kitchen. "We'll find out at the library, but I loaded the tractor already." "The tractor? How else are we going to cart 20 marionettes into town?" "We're driving to the library on a tractor?" "We're driving to the library on a tractor. Unless you've got a magic carpet you haven't told me about. And we have to leave soon to make that bus, so... you're ready?" "Yeah. I've got everything I need." "Well, not quite, you don't." She reached behind the door and drew out something that surprised Peter so much he couldn't respond. "You know what it is, right?" The baseball bat was turned perfectly smooth, the weight so solid and balanced that the world seemed to slow as he hefted it. "You made this." "But I don't need..." "I think you do. Maybe when you get where you're going, you'll figure out why." Peter ached to hand the bat back, but Vola had stayed up last night carving it for him, and she looked so proud. Maybe it was time to own one again. He balanced on his crutches and took a slow-motion swing. And the other bad memory swept him. His 7-year-old fury, a wildness he couldn't control, the exhilarating fright of that wildness, his mother's blue gazing globe, batted off its pedestal into a million shards. Her tears. "You've got to tame that temper. Don't be like him." Her bloodied fingers picking the blue glass daggers from her white roses. His shame as he watched her drive away. He slid the bat into his pack, where it fit as though it had always had a place there. Treacherous. He hoisted the pack. Underneath was the newspaper clipping. He picked it up, and his eyes caught the date. He crumpled to the chair, gut-kicked. "What?" He knew. Peter shoved the clipping across the table. He knew. This is 12 days old. So my father knew this when we left Pax. It hurt to take a breath, like knives to his lungs, when I asked to leave Pax on that old mill road because it would be safe. He knew. Peter's hands burned. He looked down. They were balled into tight fists.
He forced them open. How could he have done that? Vola came over, eyeing him carefully.
I'm sorry.
That's a very bad thing. His jaw clenched. Could teeth shatter? He forced it open. How could anyone have done that?
I know you're angry. Peter's fists had balled up again, the nails gouging his sore palms. He jammed them between his knees.
No! I told you, I don't get angry. I'm not like him. I won't be like him.
Vola sat down across from him.
Oh,
I see. I see now. But I don't think that's going to work out.
You're human, and humans feel anger.
Not me. Too dangerous.
Vola threw back her head and barked her startling laugh. Oh, let me tell you, feelings are all dangerous. Love? Hope?
Ha! Hope. You talk about dangerous, eh?
No, you can't avoid any of them. We all own a beast called anger. It can serve us. Many good things come of anger at bad things. Many unjust things are made just. But first, we all have to figure out how to civilize it.
Peter felt his wiring begin to snap.
Just one time, could you not tell me I have to figure something out? Just once, would it kill you to help? Come on, I'm leaving. You've got all this.
He waved his hand up to the bulletin board.
This wisdom. Would it kill you to send me off with some advice?
What? You want me to give you a philosophy bingo card for your trip? Like, when you smell honey in the woods, run because the bear can't be far behind?
Yeah, I guess. But for real.
Well, for real.
I don't have any magic truth to guide you. It's your trip, not mine.
But now that you bring it up, I do have a card for you.
She pulled one off the board and handed it over.
It's blank.
It is now. But a trip like this, you will find something to fill it with. A truth of your own, that you discover on your own.
At that, Peter felt suddenly exhausted, as if he'd been holding himself rigid for years. He had been on his own for so long.
Vola studied him.
Oneness is always growing in the world, boy.
Two, but not two.
It's always there, connecting its roots, humming.
I can't be a part of it. That's the price I pay for taking myself away.
But you can be.
You can vibrate with its heartbeat.
You may be on your own, but you won't be alone.
What if I get lost?
You will not get lost.
I think maybe I already am.
Vola reached across the table, cupped his head and pressed.
No.
You are found.
She got up, and Peter felt her brush a kiss on his hair as she passed. The tractor wasn't actually that uncomfortable, but it was slow and bumpy and loud. Too loud for them to talk easily, even though Peter was sitting right next to Vola.
That was okay with him. He had a lot to think about. Even after they turned onto the smoother highway shoulder, Vola was quiet. And Peter figured she had things on her mind, too. But when she pointed at a hawk wheeling overhead, he remembered something he'd always wanted to ask.
What is it with you and birds?
The feathers. Vola patted the feathers on her rawhide necklace and smiled.
Tipula.
When I was born, I reminded my parents of a bird. My hair stuck up like feathers. I had a scrawny neck, and I squawked for food all the time. I'm part Creole, part Italian, and part a dozen other things. But all people revered birds in their cultures, my parents realized. So they named me Vola. It means fly in Italian. But they called me Tipula, little chicken. My chickens grace me with feathers, and I wear them to remember that when I was born, someone saw me as a bird. That's all.
Not much of a story.
But it was a good story, Peter thought. And it explained the look she always got on her face when she lifted the rock. It would be the hardest for her to give away. He looked behind him at the four crude pine crates the marionettes were packed in, strapped to the back.
Peter hoped they didn't remind Vola of coffins. Her amazing puppets were going to live now. Really live. Out in the real world. Not just exist to perform as some kind of penance. And maybe Vola would too. But maybe that was too much to ask. He was still wondering about that when the tractor sputtered to a stop in the library parking lot, hunkering over three spaces. Vola climbed down and hoisted one of the boxes. Peter followed her, but at the wide brick steps he stopped and tapped Vola's shoulder.
"You know," he whispered, "you have to be a little careful in there."
"Careful?"
"About language, you know?"
Vola looked at him blankly. He was going to have to spell it out for her.
"It isn't the kind of place where people say Diablemon a lot."
"Oh, please. I think I know that boy." Her tone was withering, but it held the hint of a grin. Peter opened the door and swept her through. The librarian looked like a tossed handful of jewels. Bright coral scarf, gold silk blouse, sapphire blue skirt. She smiled as Vola came in and set her crate on a table. And when the top was lifted, her mouth fell into a perfect O. Peter remembered he'd been speechless too, the first time he'd seen those puppets. He backed out the door to give Vola some privacy. The morning's clouds had lifted, and the sky was so bright that it hurt his eyes. The sound seemed brighter than usual, too. Or maybe it was just because things had been so quiet this past week. A barking dog, two women chatting, bike brakes squealing, children shrieking in a playground beside the parking lot. He had missed these sounds. He had missed the world. He wondered if Vola missed it all the time. He headed over to watch the little kids playing for a few minutes. Most of them were tearing around, jumping onto and off benches, and slapping the swings in some kind of made-up game. A frowning girl with a straw-colored ponytail was digging by herself in a sandbox, earnestly moving shovelful after shovelful from one pile to another. Sitting on the sandbox corner, looking bored, with his head propped in a baseball glove, was a boy in a faded red t-shirt. The shortstop. From the ball practice. Peter moved closer. "Hey." The boy looked up, then stood, as if readying for a fight. He nodded at Peter's crutches.
"I wondered why you didn't show. How did you do?"
The shortstop scoffed. "Like you don't know you creamed us." He took the little girl's shovel and handed her a pink sweatshirt.
"Come on, let's go home."
"Wait!" Peter felt a crazy, rising panic. Maybe being a hermit for a week had made him weird already. But the boy was lifting his sister out of the sandbox, and they were going to leave, and he couldn't let that happen yet.
"Wait!
You know when you're on the field, and you know what you're supposed to do? And you're ready? When the game's about to start and the glove turns into part of your hand, and you know you're exactly where you should be. That feeling? Do you think that's peace?" The boy scowled at Peter. He shook his head as if he wanted to shake off the whole encounter, and then started walking away, pulling his sister by the hand. Peter could only watch as they left the playground, feeling that something valuable had just slipped away. At the gate, though, the shortstop turned. He was pretty far away, but it looked like maybe he wasn't frowning anymore. He lifted a hand and shut two fingers up in a peace sign. Peter lifted his own fingers back. Inside, the librarian was unpacking the last crate. Half a dozen kids had materialized, and they gaped and grinned as she lifted out each marionette. Vola stood off to the side, watching. She turned to leave when she caught sight of Peter. Peter stabbed out a crutch to block her. "Condition number 3? He asked, with a glance back to the librarian. Vola gave him a look that was half irritation, half grudging defeat. She turned back to the librarian.
"I forgot to say, B, that I'll come back once a week to teach the kids how to use them."
B Booker smiled, a slow smile that reminded Peter of melted caramel.
"That'd be awfully nice."
Vola set out for the door, but Peter blocked her path again.
Vola threw her palms up. What now? He raised two fingers.
What?
Oh, for... Fine. She walked back to the table.
B? Twice a week. I'll come twice a week, teach the kids.
The librarian broke out into a wide grin.
The children would love that. Be good to see you more, too, Vola. Maybe we could go for that coffee afterward?
A little girl with a fountain of